All right. Well, go ahead and turn to Song of Solomon, chapter 3. And I want to say thanks to Peter for teaching last time as I was out on vacation and in chapter 2. And as we begin tonight, I want you to think back to your wedding day. Some of you, that's been not too long in the past. Some of you, maybe a little longer in that. I want you to think back to what your wedding day was like, what made it different than any other day of your life. Obviously, there was a unique get-together and celebration. You probably did things that day that you have never done any other day. Ladies, you probably wore a dress that you have not worn since. You hopefully got to eat some yummy food. Maybe you just watched all your guests eat all that yummy food and things. But it was a special day. Think about what you were thinking maybe the week leading up to your wedding day. There was probably a lot of excitement, a lot of anticipation, both for that event. Maybe ladies, there was a little bit of nervousness and anxiety. Will the event go the way we're supposed to? Guys, that probably was not on your radar. There was an excitement for the ceremony and celebration, but more than that, probably for the coming together in relationship, in all aspects of that. One aspect being the physical intimacy that would be enjoyed. Well, we come today to a chapter in Song of Solomon that really points to a wedding. And it's not, again, because this is a narrative storyline between a bride and groom, and it's been building to a wedding. Some see the book that way, as we've talked about, but I think there's a number of challenges with that, and that the first couple of chapters demonstrate a level of intimacy, physical and otherwise, that I think is more characteristic of a married couple. And so it's not so much that it's a narrative story, but it's teaching us truth, looking back at a wedding day or reflecting on some of those that celebration to teach us some powerful lessons about marriage and our relationships. And this chapter really breaks into two scenes, if you were. One is in verses 1 to 5, which is really focused on the bride, on the wife, and her longing to be with her her husband, her beloved. And then in the second part of this chapter, it focuses on the celebration of marriage. And so we'll consider that together, beginning with the longing to be together. Both of these scenes really highlight the precious privilege and treasure that it is to be in relationship with our spouse. And it begins with the longing to be together. One commentator says this is a unit. This unit is one of the few in the song where the vocabulary and syntax are relatively straightforward. That's good. We've seen a lot of verses where it's like, we're not sure exactly this verse, where it only occurs here, or different things like that that are a challenge. But he says the only issue with this one is the interpretation. Okay, so we know what he's saying. The harder thing is, okay, what's going on? What's the point of this? And what we're going to see is the pursuit of a woman pursuing her, seeking, looking for her beloved. Now, some think this is a literal event taking place. Again, those who would interpret the book more as a narrative view this as she's looking for her man in anticipation of the coming wedding, seeking for him. Some see this as a dream. If you have a New American Standard, the heading to this verse, which is not inspired or in the original text, says the bride's troubled dream. So some think it is a dream that she's, or a nightmare really, that she's having, maybe leading up to the wedding day. Regardless of what's going on in those immediate circumstances, I think the point and the focus that we want to highlight is what is clear, which it reflects the intense desire of the woman to be together with her beloved. It's a longing to be together. And we see that beginning in chapter 3, verse 1. Notice it says, "On my bed, night after night, I sought him whom my soul loves." We'll see those ideas of seeking, and we will see that phrase, "whom my soul loves," repeated multiple times in this section. Verse 2, the end of that verse, "I must seek him who loves, whom my soul loves. I sought him but did not find him." Verse 3, the end, "have you seen him whom my soul loves?" Verse 4, "when I found him whom my soul loves." This is a woman who is eager to be with, to seek to be with, the one whom she loves. Begins on my bed on my bed night after night. I sought him. Now, obviously, this is where what's actually going on. Is this a historical event? Becomes the initial question. Is this woman actually lying on her bed and looking around her bed for her man? You know, I picture like, I lost him. Where did he go? You know, maybe he's under the blanket. No, he's not there. That's not what's going on, right? This is not a literal event where she's lost her man in the bedroom somewhere. It's that she is desiring to be with him and he's not with her. Again, whether this is a literal event or a dream or a reflection of her heart at some point when they're separated, you know, it's not entirely clear, but she is seeking him and desire him. And what we see then, A, is the pursuit of the beloved one. Because she longs to be with him, she is going to pursue being with him, to pursue the beloved one. That's what we see. She's looking, she's eager to be with him. Again, you can picture her looking all over the bedroom for him, but she probably would have known she's not here. She sought him, but did not find him. And so verse 2, she says, I must arise now and go about the city in the streets and in the squares. I must seek him whom my soul loves. I sought him, but did not find him. So the picture is she's looking for her man. She is looking for her beloved one. She cannot find him, so she gets up and she begins to wander about the streets of the city looking for the one whom she loves. Now, again, this is highly unlikely in a literal event. No Jewish girl, or very few, would go out at night wandering the streets looking for their beloved. Again, if this was pre-marriage, looking for her boyfriend or looking for the one that she is married to. This would have been unsafe and unheard of. To wander the streets at night would demonstrate not that you are seeking your beloved, but that you're probably a prostitute who is looking for anyone. And so this is, again, not a literal thing that she's necessarily doing as much as it's communicating the great desire that she has to be with him. Really, the fact that she expresses that in a willingness to go search among the city only heightens that desire and that pursuit of being with the one that she loves. And so she's looked for him. She sought him among the city. She still cannot find him. And verse 3 says, the watchman who made the rounds in the city found me as she is wandering looking for him. And I said, have you seen him whom my soul loves? There's no response from them. The indication being, no, they haven't seen him. Don't know where he is. There's been a lot of debate about what these watchmen represent. Everything from just a picture of what's going on in this metaphor to the watchman representing her virginity and the fact that that's what's kind of causing her anxiety and anticipation of her marriage. Again, I don't think we can be definitive on if or what they represent as much as the fact that she is going to great lengths to find the one that she loves to be with him. And in this case, she's watched or she's looked for him. She's gone out to the city to see where he could be, to find him. She has sought the help of those who might know. What would you expect the normal reaction to be at this point for this woman? Well, at some point you would say she should probably give up, right? She can't find him. You know, she's gone, looked everywhere. She's asked the appropriate people. And so you would expect that she would return home, or you would expect that maybe she would begin trying to satisfy that desire in another way, you know, maybe with another man, or maybe she would have chocolate and go shopping or whatever it is, because she can't get what she wants. But she doesn't do that. Verse 4 says, scarcely had I left them when I found him. So she continues to pursue him. Even when she has been unable to find him throughout the city on her own, when the watchmen have been no help to her, she continues to go on searching. It's a consuming passion and a consuming desire, a consuming pursuit. Because this is to characterize our relationship with our spouse. The great longing to be with them, to be in relationship with them, and to be present with them. And that desire should drive us to pursue them, to pursue being with them. Now, again, this is a metaphor. This is not saying, like, ladies, when your husband goes to work, you wake up frantic, and or you walk around the house looking for him. Where'd he go? And you go out looking for him, and eventually you find him at work, and you're like, ah, this is good. We're together. That's not the point. The point, though, is this is an eager longing to be together, to enjoy the relationship that God has given. Now, we'll see down below in verse 4 that I think this is both a desire for relationship, and as we've seen even in chapter 1, it's a desire for relational intimacy, but also for physical intimacy. When she finds him, and we'll come back to this in a minute, look at verse 4. It says, I found him whom my soul loves. I held on to him. I would not let him go until I had brought him to my mother's house and into the room of her who conceived me. Now, we'll talk a little more about that, but I think that's probably an expression of the desire for physical intimacy with him and the desire to be in that relationship with him. And so this is both a desire to be with in general and a desire for physical or sexual intimacy. And you guys, this is a good desire that's intended to drive us to pursue our spouse. It's intended to drive us toward our spouse, pursuing that relationship, both husbands and wives. It's good to pursue one another in this way. It's good to delight in and desire that. But I want to think with you to think with me for a second about the God-given desire, particularly the sexual desire that God has given us and why. You know, some who have spent most of their life thinking about how we're not to engage in sexual intimacy before marriage tend to think of sex drive or the desire for that as almost a bad thing. And it's hard to flip the switch when you get married to say, no, this is a great thing that I want to enjoy physical intimacy with my spouse. And yet it's a gift of God, that desire that is intended to drive us to pursue relationship with our spouse, not just sexual relationship, but general relationship that includes sexual intimacy. In fact, I think Tim Challies has an excellent quote in his book, Sexual Detox, about this, particularly addressed to men, but I think it's broader than that. It says, the Bible is clear that legitimate sexual desire, desire within a marriage and a desire for one's spouse, is legitimate before God. God gives a man sexual desire, an appetite for that, because he wants him to have sex with his wife. It's good that we want to have sex. God made it that way. God made sex for marriage and marriage for sex. Sexual desire motivates a man, and this is key, in part to pursue a wife and marry her so that together they can enjoy sex. Now, that's not to be the only reason why a man pursues his wife or pursues marriage or a woman in the same way, but it's part of it. And he says that same desire, listen to this, motivates a man in part to keep pursuing his wife or his wife pursuing her husband even after they are married. And he compares it this way. He says, without this desire, this appetite, it would be far easier for us to avoid carrying out our God-given duty to have sex and thus to experience intimacy and unity. He says, do you see the beauty and goodness of this? God gave us a desire that is meant to be fulfilled. If we did not experience hunger, we might not eat. If we stop eating for too long, we'll suffer harm. You see that? If we don't desire to eat, we might never do it, and eating is a good thing that is necessary for our life. In the same way, he says, that sexual desire is a good thing. If we did not experience that sexual desire, we might not have sex, and if we stop having sex by choice, our marriages will suffer from a lack of intimacy and slide towards relational death. Sexual desire, then, and this is what I really want you to think about, particularly men, is a gift of God, not to torment us, but to motivate our obedience. When a husband inevitably feels sexual desire, it is not an invitation towards pornography and masturbation, but a nudge towards pursuing his wife. You see that? That desire to be together generally and that desire for sexual intimacy is a good gift from God that is intended to drive us to pursue our spouse. Now, in a fallen world, when we're sinful and our spouse is sinful, sometimes the pursuit doesn't go as well as it's described in this chapter. Sometimes we've sinned against our spouse, or our spouse has sinned against us, and so the pursuit is not going to go as well as is described here. The desire for that relationship. And what so often we do is we say, well, fine, I'm going to set aside that desire or the fulfillment of that desire with my spouse, and I'm going to pursue that elsewhere. For men, that's often things like pornography. But it's any pursuit that we say, well, I'm not getting that relationship here, I'm going to get it somewhere else. No, that desire is intended to keep driving us back to pursue and delight in our spouse. And so we see that here, the pursuit, the pursuing of the beloved one. And it's only one. She's got a singular focus. I want this with my beloved one. And the result when she finds him, B, there is the clinging to the beloved one. Notice verse 4 again. She says, scarcely had I left them when I found him. And I held on to him and would not let him go. This is a strong verb for seizing. It's in fact the same word that was used back in chapter 2, verse 15, to catch the little foxes that are ruining the vineyards. In the same way that you were to catch the foxes and not let them go, she caught her beloved and she would not let him go. And she says, I would not let him go until I brought him to my mother's house and into the room of her who conceived me. There's again debate. Is she talking literally? I took him to mom's house and went into the mom's bedroom where I was conceived. And, you know, we had some fun at mom's house. Or is she using it in a metaphorical sense? Some think she's talking about the womb where all conception takes place. Either way, there's an innuendo of sexual relationship in what she is talking about. She pursues him and she clings to him. And she says, you are mine in this way. It reminds me of Genesis 2 where in verse 24, a man shall leave his father and mother and be joined to his wife. Or some translations, cling to his wife and they shall become one flesh. That's the desire to be together, the pursuit of, and then the clinging to one another. You know, you probably had that mindset the week before you got married, maybe more than that. You know, you had this desire to be with and to pursue and to cling to. But unfortunately for most, if not all of us, that desire wanes. I think, you know, we get a one that we wanted and then it's like, OK, I'm not going to pursue anymore. We're kind of stuck together. We've made this covenant and we're here. And so we can lose this zeal to pursue and to cling to one another. But that's God's intent for our relationship. But it goes from this pursuit and clinging to a reminder of, the importance of waiting for the beloved one. This is not in the context of the marriage, but she turns now in verse 5 and gives that warning, which we see multiple times. We saw it in chapter 2. Verse 5, I adjure you, O daughters of Jerusalem. She turns now from speaking of her beloved one to speaking to the other maidens in Jerusalem and says, O daughters of Jerusalem, by the gazelles or by the hinds of the field, that you will not arouse or awaken. And you see my, if you have a New American Standard, it's italicized. It's not in the original, but not awaken love until she pleases. It's a reminder that this pursuit and this clinging to one is only to take place in the right time or the right season, and that season is in marriage. It's an exclusive relationship. You know, this is a reminder to us, I think, as we are involved with our kids, that marriage and the relationship between a man and a woman is an incredible gift to be enjoyed. And we're to model that for our kids and to talk to our kids about that this is a great delight. And yet we're also to teach them that there's a time for that type of a relationship and it's not now for you yet. Don't awaken that. Don't even begin to go down that road until it is time. Don't arouse or awaken that until it's the appropriate season of life. So many encourage the arousal of love, but say only go so far. No, we got to be so careful to teach and train our children, that there is a priority in waiting. You see this even with Adam. Before he formed, before God gave him Eve, he didn't have Eve. He had himself and a whole bunch of animals, and he's pairing them up and naming them and thinking, you know, it's I wish I had somebody to be with. And he refers to the fact that really at last God has given me a woman in Genesis 2. That's the beauty of waiting. It makes you appreciate what you have. That's why sexual intimacy and the joy of marital intimacy is so exalted in this book, in part because it's off limits for a while, and then when we get it, it's a great delight. And that doesn't mean if there's been sexual sin in your past or your spouse's past that you cannot have a delightful, joyous marriage, but it's a reminder that there's a time and a season for that. So we see this longing to be together, particularly from the perspective of the wife, again, reflective of both spouses, though, I think, of this desire to be with that results in pursuing one another and clinging to one another. And then in the second half of this chapter, we see really a picture of coming together. There's the longing to be together and then the picture of coming together. And it records for us what most would recognize is a wedding celebration or a wedding processional. You see, again, that heading probably in your Bible, Solomon's wedding day. We really see this clearly at the end of verse 11. It says, on the day of his wedding and on the day of his gladness of heart, seems to indicate that this is a wedding processional that we're going to see. Notice verse 6 says, what is this coming up from the wilderness like columns of smoke perfumed with myrrh and frankincense with all scented powders of the merchant? It says, behold, it is the traveling couch of Solomon, 60 mighty men around it of the mighty men of Israel, all of them wielders of the sword, expert in war. Each man has his sword at his side, guarding against the terrors of the night. Solomon has made for himself a sedan chair from the timber of Lebanon, made its posts of silver, its back of gold, its seat of purple fabrics, with its interior lovingly fit out by the daughters of Jerusalem. It's this processional of someone being carried in on this chair or couch that is being supported by others and surrounded by these warriors. It begins in verse 6 there, what is this coming? Or literally it's who is this coming? And so the speaker has shifted from the woman in the first part of this chapter now to what is most likely the chorus or the onlookers who are seeing this processional coming, seeing the cloud of smoke or dust rising in the distance and saying, what is this or who is this that's coming? Now, the pronoun there is feminine, so it seems to indicate that this is the one riding on this couch or this chair, this means of being transported, again, probably hoisted up by men carrying it, a royal procession, that the one riding on it is feminine, so it's probably the lady coming, being delivered to the wedding celebration, although there's some debate about that. And so what we see first in this picture of them coming together is a picture, I think, of celebration. You know, there's, I think we probably assume the fact that weddings are celebrations and we go to them as celebrations, but why is that? Well, in this case, notice the nature of this celebration. There's this entourage coming from the wilderness. Again, this is probably, again, not literal in the sense that this is exactly how the wedding took place. They didn't necessarily go out to the wilderness and that's where they got together and then marched in that way. Although some see that in the narrative flow of this, particularly the Shulamite being more of a rural girl coming into the city. But more than likely, this is just a description of the processional coming in, and you see the columns of smoke, maybe from the incense, maybe again just the dust of them coming in, and you see or hear the smell of myrrh and frankincense. Now, it's unlikely that if you couldn't see who's coming, that you could smell the myrrh and frankincense if it's a big processional off in the distance. I mean, that'd be some pretty strong perfume that they're wearing, right? So again, the point is not all the details here. The point is it's an amazing scene. You see the celebration down in verse 11. Go forth, O daughters of Zion. Gaze on King Solomon with his crowns, which his mother has crowned him on the day of his wedding and on the day of his gladness of heart. Solomon's excited. There's gladness in his heart. And others are gathering around to join in the gladness and to see that. His weddings are a public celebration. There's a lot of pomp and circumstance that go with that. Now, with five daughters, I've tried to set lower expectations of some of that pomp and circumstance. There's no reason you can't wear the same dress or something. I mean, come on. No, this is a reminder to me, though, that it is a special day. Why is that? Why do we celebrate? Why do we throw a big party in connection to our weddings? You see that in Scripture. It's not just an American cultural thing. It's an everywhere cultural thing. Why is that? Well, it's certainly that it's a public thing because there's to be witnesses of that covenant and certainly delight in the people. You know, people come to a wedding because you know the folks who are getting married and you love them. But it's really a celebration of the gift of marriage, the good gift of coming together. It's that longing that woman had in the first part of this chapter, saying, I want to be with my man. And you celebrate because, she gets to be. Get to have that relationship and that intimacy. God says it's not good for man to be alone or woman to be alone. And so, therefore, we delight in that longing being fulfilled. You know, certainly the public celebration of marriage lasts only a brief while. In biblical times, it would last longer, like a week. And in our times, you know, it's a couple hours or whatever. And so that celebration fades, but the delight in and the joy and gladness of being married ought not fade. Again, that doesn't mean you're going to have the same, you know, zeal and shine on your face as you did on your wedding day every day. But it means we should delight in and rejoice in that gift. Proverbs says we're to delight in the wife of our youth. You know, this may have faded for you. Marriage may just be something you are going through the motions in and something that you see more challenges in than delight. God says rekindle that celebratory spirit, that gladness that comes from your marriage. So it's a picture of celebration of the delight and the good gift that marriage is. But it's also a picture, secondly, of protection. A picture of protection. Notice this caravan coming in, verse 7, behold, it's the traveling couch of Solomon. Again, there's some debate about what exactly this is. Is it how much of a, is it like a bed versus a throne? And some of that, it's just difficult to know. But notice as they're coming in, and again, probably the woman riding on this, again, not necessarily literally, but picturing this celebration and ceremony. It says 60 mighty men around it. Of the mighty men of Israel, all of them are wielders of the sword, expert in war. Each man has his sword at his side, guarding against the terrors of the night. I wish I had read this more before my wedding and I could have like all the groomsmen wearing swords or something. It'd be pretty sweet. What's the picture here? Well, the picture is of this bride coming to the wedding, most likely, and the scene of protection that is there. Again, are there going to be 60 men around her all the time with swords protecting her? Is it like her Secret Service detail who's going to be with her forever? No, I think it's, a metaphor, a picture of the protection, though, that comes from that relationship. It comes from marriage. And particularly it says guarding against what? Verse 9, the terrors of the night. Maybe that's some of that anxiety from the previous scene of hesitancy of what's going on and where is her guy. Now it's concrete. We are married. We are together. I know this is an enduring relationship. Maybe it's other anxieties and fear. Now, ultimately, Psalm 91 says that we are not afraid of the terror by night because of our trust in the Lord. So it's not that wives, your primary source of protection is your husband. Your primary source of protection is the Lord. But one of the vehicles that he has given to protect is your husband. That's a role that God has given, a privilege that comes in that relationship. Now, husbands, we're to protect our wives with humility, recognizing our limitations. You probably don't have 60 guys with swords that you can call on to help protect your wife, but it's just you and go get them. But we are to walk with our wives throughout life and to offer protection and care. Not I'm going to keep you from every possible harm. You can't do that. You can tell your wife everything's going to go fine, but you don't have a guarantee of that. But what you can say is by God's grace, as long as I'm alive, I'm going to be with you and walk through whatever we face. I'm going to bear the brunt of it, as it were. How are husbands to protect their wives? What do we protect our wives from? Well, certainly you can give some consideration to that and talk with your wife about it. But, you know, we're to protect our wives from sin and temptation. You know, guarding our home and cultivating holiness. That's what Ephesians 5 calls us to wash our wives, to help them to grow in purity, to protect from physical harm. It's right for us to be careful of the physical situations that we allow our wife to be in, to make sure that we're not putting her in harm's way, to protect her from overwork and overcommitment, to be one who's willing to help shepherd and guide and in those things. So this wedding ceremony or processional is a picture of celebration of the joy of that relationship and of the protection that the bride is to find underneath her husband, ultimately under the Lord. And then thirdly, I think it's a picture of provision. Notice this chair, verse 9, King Solomon has made for himself a sedan chair. Again, exactly what this is. There's been a lot of ink spilled. But he's made this from the timber of Lebanon. It's a fancy wood piece that he's made its post of silver and its back of gold and its seat of purple fabric with its interior lovingly fitted out by the daughters of Jerusalem. It's a picture of this exquisite piece that she is traveling on, in part just to communicate the great value that he places on her. It's an expression of love and delight in her, treating her like a princess or a queen. Again, literally that way for Solomon, but metaphorically, that's the attitude that's to be displayed. And also, it's a picture, I think, of the provision that he has, that he's going to be caring for her. He has these resources to bless her and to provide. So when we come together in marriage, there's to be protection and provision offered by the husband to the wife and a celebration of those different things. Notice then, verse 11, we mentioned it already. It says, "Oh, go forth, O daughters of Zion, and gaze on King Solomon with the crown which his mother has crowned him on the day of his wedding, on the day of his gladness of heart." He says, "This is what I have been longing for." Just as the woman in the beginning of this chapter was eagerly desiring to be with her husband, so Solomon here pictures the man saying, "This is what I have longed for, to be with, to be in relationship with my wife." Because this is a powerful picture, isn't it, of the desire and delight that we are to have in our spouse. Again, there's we'll see in the coming chapter in particular, a big part of that desire is the physical sexual desire that exists within marriage. But it's more than that. It's a desire for intimacy of relationship in general, a desire to pursue one another. You know, when your relationship feels like it's getting a little bit cold in some area, the right response is not to say, "Well, fine, I'll just busy myself somewhere else." No, it's to pursue one another. And if both husband and wife have that attitude, you're not going to drift apart very long before you're running after one another, clinging to one another, cultivating the intimacy that God calls. Again, I would suspect that we all had that desire and that heart when we got married, that was what we were anticipating and expecting. And yet, as the time goes, it's easy to lose that. Well, I think this passage is a reminder to us not to lose that focus, not to let our relationship grow cold, but to delight in and pursue one another in this way. Let's pray together, and then we'll split into our groups tonight. Father, thank you for this time. Thank you for this powerful picture of the right desire that we are to have to pursue our spouse, to long to be with them, to cling to them, to delight in them, in both the relationship and the intimacy that we can enjoy in just being with one another and living life together with the protection and provision that comes from that relationship and also the physical intimacy that we can enjoy. Lord, help us to just be eager for those things and to pursue those, not to accept any substitute in our lives for the pursuit of loving our spouse and delighting in and cherishing our spouse. Lord, give us the gladness of heart that we experienced on our wedding day when we were overjoyed with the good gift of a spouse that you gave us. Might that be what characterizes us every day. May we be even more excited today and next week and next month and next year at the gift of marriage because we have grown in our love for one another and our appreciation for that gift. Lord, we thank you for this time. We thank you for this book that speaks to these issues of life, and we commit the rest of our night to you. In Christ's name, amen.